Open up the House Committee on Human Services, and I open up a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 162.
Okay. Senate Bill 162 prohibits the Department of Human Services or area agencies on aging from disclosing the protected personal information of adult foster home residents in mandated reports, and that prohibits the disclosure of residents' name or any other identifying demographic information, as well as information about mental or physical health conditions, provision of health care, or payment for health care by a resident.
Thank you, Kaylee. And who do we have presenting this bill? Good morning again, Mary.
Thank you.
Happy early good morning to you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Mary Geer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. And I'll give my thanks to the chair this morning for the extra half hour. I'm delighted to be here this morning to testify in support of Senate Bill 162. This is a bill that was introduced at the request of the governor on behalf of the department. The problem that we're seeking to solve with this legislation is one of the balance that we as the department seek between disclosing enough information about providers and any allegations of abuse that they may have against them, and balancing that with the privacy of the individuals who have been abused. So in current practice, the statute requires that any allegations of abuse or neglect or rule violations against adult foster home providers be made public. We do that in a couple of different ways. Reports are available in the local offices, the area agencies on aging, or local SPD offices. We also have a website that puts up allegations against providers. Actually, they're just the substantiated allegations against all kinds of long-term care providers. The difficulty is that with adult foster homes, there are often from 1 to 5 individuals in a home. And even though we never disclose protected health information as protected by HIPAA and state law, there is often enough identifying information in the public report to be able to know who the individual is in the home that we're talking about, because there are so few individuals. So, for example, a report might say a woman in her 50s who uses a wheelchair. There's nothing protected about her health status in that statement, but it may be very easy to identify who that individual is in a home where there's 3 or 4 or 5 people. So what we're asking in this bill is that it gives the department the authority to redact further information from reports of substantiated and allegations of abuse and neglect. So it would allow us to redact any physical or mental health diagnoses, any conditions that might identify the individual, their gender, any financial information. This is especially important when a victim has been financially exploited and may identify them as vulnerable to further exploitation, and any dates, like date of admission, date of birth, those kinds of things. I just wanted to be clear that this statute addresses adult foster homes. There's a whole different set of regulations that prevent disclosure of information about children, including their location in foster homes. So these are adults. And these are foster homes that serve people with developmental disabilities, people who have disabilities related to mental illness and addiction, and seniors and people with physical disabilities. So given that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have about this bill and its intent.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
Any questions of this witness? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, do we have anybody in opposition to this?
I don't think anybody has signed up. Okay. Anybody in the audience who is in opposition to this?
And does the ACLU weighed in on this? Because they're one of their... you know, the dueling roles they have is open records, open public records, and because we have this on several competing bills, not
right.
this bill,
right.
saying, well, we've got, you know, we want public records to be as open as possible. So I would assume that they would have weighed in on this and said, kind of given a thumbs up or a thumb sideways or...
If they had a problem.
If they had an issue. Mm-hmm.
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer.
I think we got something else. Huh?
Pardon me. This was heard on the Senate side, and the only... it wasn't even really opposition presented was by Grover Simmons of the Independent Foster Home Association. He actually wanted to put in an amendment about not disclosing information about non-substantiated allegations. That's a issue that Grover and I have gone back and forth with on for several years. So it wasn't really directly related to this. We've not heard from anyone else who had concerns about this. And certainly we worked with our mental health colleagues on this issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. And no one else has signed up or wishes to give testimony on this. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill one or Senate Bill 162 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 162.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson recommends that Senate Bill 162 be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, I'm going to just, how do I say that?
Motion passes by acclamation.
Motion passes by acclamation, unless there is a problem with that. Thank you. So Senate Bill 162 passes. Should we send this to the consent calendar, or does somebody feel like we should speak about this on the floor? It seems to me it's a pretty good consent. Anybody
really
have a problem with that?
No opposition.
No opposition, right? No. Okay, so we'll go into the consent calendar, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 162. And open up the public hearing on House Bill 3022.
House Bill 3022 allows medical practitioners who diagnose patients with gonorrhea or chlamydia to prescribe antibiotic treatment for the patient and the patient's partners without an examination of the partners. It requires that practitioners provide informational materials about sexually transmitted diseases provided by the Department of Human Services and specific dosage information for the patient and each partner for whom medication is described. It also creates some exceptions in statutes pertaining to the dispensation to allow for this extra release of medications.
Okay, thank you. And I think we have a group of people signed up to testify on this. I have a list that was written. Tom, do you want to come on up and... you want somebody else to come on up. Kat, come on up. And I understand that Representative Greenlick won't be available until 9:30.
He's not going to make it at all.
Okay, all right. Okay, the new list. Thank you. Okay, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Kat Livingston. I'm a family physician and preventive medicine resident and also an intern for Representative Mitch Greenlick. I'm here to speak on my own behalf as well as Representative Greenlick, who unfortunately is unable to be here today, in support of House Bill 3022 for expedited partner therapy. This bill makes sense. It's good preventive medicine. Half of all partners and patients with gonorrhea and chlamydia go untreated. This means that a patient is fully treated, goes back, has intercourse with their partner, and comes back in several months again with reinfection with gonorrhea and chlamydia. Expedited partner treatment will decrease infection and reinfection rates, decreasing the spread of these diseases in our community, as well as preventing all the potential sequelae, including pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, chronic pelvic pain, and others. At Outside In, a clinic in downtown Portland serving a large, poor, and homeless population, I saw a homeless young woman who I diagnosed with chlamydia. She said that there was no way that her partner would come in. It was a mixture of transportation and fear of the physician, but this is a perfect situation in which I could give her a prescription that she could give to her partner, decreasing the risk that both of them would continue to have chlamydia. This bill empowers the patients to ensure that they can be safer and decreases the transmission of sexually transmitted infections. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend it. The American Medical Association recommends it. It's good medicine and good policy. I, and on behalf of Representative Mitch Greenlick, urge you to support House Bill 3022.
Thank you very much, Kat. Any questions of this? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have any associations weighed in on this or anything? I mean, it sounds like it makes sense. Does it put any, and you as a provider have testified it doesn't, but is there anybody that thinks it puts any undue pressure on the provider or anything at all?
It's absolutely up to the provider to choose whether or not they wish to provide expedited partner treatment. So there's no pressure for them to provide it. It only provides the option for those who wish to do it. The American Medical Association supports it, the Oregon Nurses Association, and later testifiers can talk about the other national organizations that have supported this.
Thank you.
And colleagues, I should have pointed out you have a folder in front of you, and you have a lot of written testimony that will explain this bill even further and the support that it has from many fronts. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I support this. I just want to ask a question about it. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I guess the best analogy I can give is I carry strep, so when it's going around, I call in and I often, I'm fine, don't worry. I'll call and I'll need it. You know, I know when I need it. I know when I'm getting something. And so I try to keep antibiotics on hand just in case, especially when I travel. So I guess my question is I get this all the time. Well, you have to come in because they need to know what else is going on with you. So if someone is coming in and getting a prescription for someone who's not there, will there be the question that the doctor will have of the person who's not there, what else is going on with them, what medications they're taking, what might interact, et cetera?
The ideal situation would always be to have every patient come in to be able to do a full evaluation, you know, to look for other sexually transmitted infections. This really is when that patient would not come in, when there is no, you know, for whatever reason, for multiple limitations, they're not going to come into the doctor. So the choice is not, let's do a full history and physical versus let's kind of just give them a medicine. The choice is, this is a person who would just walk around with chlamydia who would come in versus getting them treated for that. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's absolutely the best potential solution that we have. And it also decreases the risk of them transmitting other infections, because if you have one infection, then it may increase the risk of HIV and other transmission as well.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Representative
Kat, I have two. Thanks, Kat. And just following up on Representative Boone. Well, following up on her, first of all, let me say I'm also very supportive of this bill. But when a prescription is given to a patient for a partner, the partner still has to go into the pharmacy and will probably have some kind of consultation with a pharmacist know about whether they're allergic to certain things, or will that still happen under this? Is that a safeguard? I guess that's a question.
So is it okay if I call up my fellow testifiers?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they can talk about the details. So, Dr.
First testifier.
Bradley and others.
Instead of the rest of the...
Thank you for coming to testify today.
Chair Tomei and Committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the Administrator for the Office of Family Health.
And Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Beth Epstein. I'm a family medicine doctor, a public health physician. I'm wearing several hats today. I'm the health officer for Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman County, and I'm also the medical consultant for the Office of Family Health.
Thank you for coming today.
Chair Tomei, before we give our testimony, perhaps what I could do is ask Dr. Epstein to respond to Representative Brough's question.
Great. And just to make sure, Representative Dembro, to make sure I understood the question, you were asking about what the protocol would happen at the pharmacy if someone showed up with a prescription. This won't change how pharmacists interact with their patients. So, for instance, if someone is given a prescription for expedited partner therapy as the partner of someone who's infected, they'll get the same education at the pharmacy that they would get normally. If it's a new prescription for them, we presume that they would get, you know, the little consultation with the pharmacist and the questions that are asked. One difference might be that there may not be a name on that prescription. That's one of the provisions in this, is that we want to be able to have doctors or other providers write prescriptions for people when the name isn't even disclosed. So that's one of the changes that would happen for the pharmacist. But otherwise, we expect that the interaction would be similar. Sometimes this won't be a matter of carrying a prescription. It will sometimes be a matter of medication being dispensed, as in from our sexually transmitted disease clinics, where we may have stocks of medicine on hand that can be dispensed. So it may be actually a take-home pack of medicine that would have low literacy instructions to the patient on taking it, including warnings about allergies and so on. Did that address your question?
Yes. Just follow up. So, again, we're talking, you know, I think as Dr. Livingston said, we're talking about a balancing act here, right? I mean, there are some downsides to that, downsides to having a blank name, you know, on a
yes.
prescription. But the positives, you know, on the whole outweigh the negatives. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. I think the language that the CDC has put around this is really helpful. They say this is not the best option. Everybody would rather bring a patient in and counsel them in person and evaluate them and test them and really give them that personal service. But this is an important alternative when those patients' partners can't come in, because we so desperately need to break those cycles of infection and reinfection. I think Dr. Livingston alluded to this, that there's really something pretty ugly that happens when people get repeat infections with chlamydia and gonorrhea. Each cycle of reinfection increases the inflammation in the body. Usually the first infection is not the one that causes lifelong sequela, but every time...
And the sequela is?
Consequences. For instance, infertility, chronic pelvic pain, pelvic inflammatory disease, increased risk of tubal pregnancy. But each time a young woman's body goes through a subsequent cycle of reinfection, there's a hotter inflammatory response and more tissue damage, and it's more likely that she's going to go on and suffer those ill consequences. So breaking that cycle of infection early is particularly important.
And could I just ask one other follow-up? And this is something you probably, or you may talk about later, but why is it just chlamydia and gonorrhea? Why not other STIs would be covered?
At this point, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, has run four really good quality randomized control studies to sort of, you know, say, we need evidence. This seems like a good idea. This seems common sense. But is it supported by the scientific evidence? They looked at other diseases, specifically trichomonas, and I think bacterial vaginosis. I'm actually not sure. But they looked at other diseases, and these were the two, chlamydia and gonorrhea, where there was actually strong evidence that there was real benefit, that you got lower reinfection rates and that you weren't seeing harm. Now, a disease like syphilis, for instance, obviously very serious, but the treatment isn't something that you just send home pills. It's a treatment with injection. So it's not amenable to this kind of treatment. So sort of looking at which diseases are amenable, which diseases are common, and this problem of reinfection is common, and then where did the scientific evidence fall out? And there was really very strong evidence that we could significantly reduce the reinfection rates for these two diseases. In fact, in 2001, California first made it legal to do this for chlamydia, and then only in 2007 came back and added gonorrhea. So they've sort of gone on a, had to go back and reopen their laws as other evidence has accumulated. And it may be that we will find down the road that there are other diseases for which this is a good option, but right now these are the diseases that we have strong evidence that this is good practice.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. That was very helpful.
You're welcome, Representative. Representative Maurer, did you have a question?
I did, Madam Chair, and I don't want to be contrary, but I think, in fact, you do need to have a name of a partner on the prescription. because that's what the bill says.
Yes, it does.
So if that is an issue, then
I would
ask, does that, you know, is the language wrong in the bill? How does it?
Did you want to address that, Catherine?
Yeah. Representative Tomei and Representative Maurer, this is Catherine Bradley. At this point in time, the way this is written is it does expect, there is the expectation that it is a named partner, and that it actually is not. That was part of one of the agreements we did have with the pharmacy board in our conversations about what was the right opportunity and what was the right way to structure this. So the intent at this time is that it is actually a named partner.
Okay.
It's obvious we're in a slight disagreement.
I would support that.
That it remain in the bill.
Remain as it is worded.
I'm pretty sure.
In the original, Representative Maurer, in the original legislative concept that we had drafted with, in concert with the legal counsel for the Board of Pharmacy, he had suggested that we create an exception so that only under the circumstances of expedited partner therapy there would be this ability to write prescriptions for unnamed partners. I believe California, for instance, gives the option of naming the partner, saying partner of so-and-so patient, or using sort of a John Doe approach. And that was how this was originally drafted. Unfortunately, in the draft that we got, they actually switched the wording, and it now says that it does specify a named partner, but that was always part of the intent in doing this, and the Board of Pharmacy was actually part of the decision that this would try to incorporate the ability for providers to write prescriptions for unnamed partners.
One quick follow-up. Who's going to pay for this?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, what the evidence has indicated is that while there is an increased number of prescriptions, there is actually a decreased cost to the system in terms of reinfection rates and treatment, so that the way that cost effectiveness in the literature indicates is that actually it's more effective to move forward with this because the costs are decreased in subsequent care.
I still didn't hear the answer to that question.
And Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, actually, we do have a couple of amendments we are actually going to be recommending for this bill, and one of the issues does relate to that specifically, and I stand corrected. Dr. Epstein was correct. What I have down here is that a prescription provided or dispensed for expedited partner therapy in accordance with the rules will be valid, notwithstanding the fact that the patient's name is not on the prescription. So that was actually the final decision that we had with the Board of Pharmacy. It would be very specifically related only to this particular type of therapy and would be narrow to that.
Madam Chair, I guess a couple points on who pays for it. Is it two prescriptions and therefore we have two copays, or is it a single prescription? Because I think it would, quite frankly, be very inappropriate to squeeze two people on one prescription. In fact, you actually are having to write two prescriptions.
And Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, it actually is two prescriptions. So the individual...
So it would be treated as separate.
It would be treated separately.
Okay. I still didn't hear the answer to the question about who pays. Who pays for the prescription?
Chair Tomei, the prescription, if there is a third-party insurer, would be potentially paid under the third-party insurer. If it's under the public health system, then it may be dispensed out of a packet or a prescription under the state STD program.
Okay. Follow-up?
If you write a prescription to Jane Doe or John Doe, or usually you know how that works, to John Doe, partner of, how is that, if you had insurance, how would that be treated?
Not very well.
I mean, is Blue Cross Regents going to recognize that as a legitimate prescription for Jane Doe? I mean, if I was the insurance company, I'd go, that's not, I mean, that's, now these are not expensive prescriptions. I mean, these are very inexpensive. In fact, your copay probably is more than the cost of the drug, so maybe it's a non-issue.
Well, Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, I'll try to tackle that. excuse me. It's
unfortunately, like everything else in our healthcare system, it's going to be a bit of a patchwork, and we don't have all the answers to that. Right now, a lot of medications for sexually transmitted diseases are paid for by the public health system, and we anticipate that that would still be the case for a lot of these. We also, in private clinics, have people who are walking off with prescriptions that they don't have coverage for, and they're getting them paid for out of their own pocket. Or the clinics have arrangements with the drug companies to get free or low-cost medication. We really looked at whether we needed to have all these discussions with all the different insurers before we moved forward with suggesting this change to law, but we strongly felt that there's the scientific evidence that this is a best practice that should be available, and that we need to solve those problems of how things will be paid for down the way, and it's going to be many different answers for many different patients, but that we needed to have it as an option. It could be a real option already right now for all the patients who are being treated in the publicly funded clinics. And again, as Dr. Bradley said, we anticipate that it would actually be cost-saving because you might be giving out two prescriptions up front or three, but you're not going to be ending up with as many reinfections who really need much higher level of care as well as the medication.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably a silly question, but given with what you do, I'm hoping that there's a bit of that other little speech that you might give to the patient about, you know, prophylactic care. And that if we, you know, if people think that they can just continually come in if they get infected or reinfect or infect some other people and say, oh, no, I can get you a prescription, we're not doing the job of the education piece of it. And I think the bigger message to the patient in that sense, the young woman, is if you continually get this disease because you're not being careful or whatever, you might end up infertile or whatever the consequences are. And I think that that's a message that should probably get out to the patients in that sense, and that being careful, you know, with what you're doing, not only prevents somebody else from getting the disease, but it prevents you from having the future problems. And I don't know what your policy is.
Right. Representative Tomei and Representative Boone, I think you just stated, you know, part of the conundrum of this very well. Ideally, again, we would love to have every patient in front of us so we could give them the passionate, detailed counseling that we generally do. But there are so many times when those partners aren't coming in. One of the advantages of passing this law will be that we'll be able to standardize the practice of expedited partner therapy. There have been national studies that show this is going on all the time. It is something that it's common sense, and a provider who's faced with a young woman saying, there's no way my partner's coming in, he'll never come in, an awful lot of prescriptions are getting written or medicines being dispensed, but they're not being sent home with appropriate directions. They're not being sent home with low language literacy directions. They may not have directions in different languages. There may not be much guidance for the provider to help them make sure they're selecting the ideal patient for this circumstance. And the 11 states that have already moved forward on this and have legalized this, there's beautiful toolkits on the web available for providers so they can print off written materials. You know, here's how you do expedited partner therapy. Here's the information that you send home with the patient. Here's the questions, you know, that in low language literacy levels that the patients need to ask. It's not ideal. We can't guarantee they'll be reading them, but at least it sets up a standard of care so that when it is being done, when it is necessary, when it is our alternative that we have to choose, it's being done in a good standard. So I don't know if that addressed.
Yeah, and just a quick follow-up. I guess that it is a conundrum and it is a problem for you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to make it so that these people go, boy, I'm not going there again, you know, because you want them to come in and get treated. And that's
right.
I don't know how we educate people to be more responsible, but that's a whole other issue. So, but thank you.
Something?
Yeah.
No matter how many laws we make.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, I'd also like to add, in those studies that were mentioned earlier, these randomized controlled trials, they looked at those partners later on, and they found that their levels of risky behaviors were much lower. So the education that's been happening, whether it's through the pharmacist or through the partner who was treated, who's actually seen by the physician, is really affecting the at least the short-term behaviors of these partners. So there is some education that's going on. A lot of it seems to relate to empowerment of the patient that we're treating, and through them, the teaching of their partner. So it is, you know, as has been said, this isn't ideal, but there is a lot of learning that's going on, and the studies really support that this works.
Yeah. I just might say, I think that we should support this because every little bit we can help, I think, moves it forward, and like you said, you might catch somebody's attention at some point. So thank you.
Catherine, I think you probably have some prepared testimony.
Chair Tomei, we do, and I will just touch on a couple of highlights because I think in much of this discussion we've covered many things. As I indicated earlier, I'm Catherine Bradley, and I'm here representing the Department of Health Services, and we are requesting your support for House Bill 3022. What we did want to share with you is this was actually a conversation that we had with our boards, with the Board of Nursing, with the Board of Pharmacy, with the Board of Medicine, in terms of what would be the best way to sort of move forward. And there was great support for the concept, but concern about having to sort of individually do it across the system. The assumption was that it would be much more effective to move forward with actually working with the OARs. I will note for you that we do have a couple of amendments that will be coming forward on this. One of the issues is that the OAR is not the OAR that we are actually recommending that this be housed within. The OAR that's on this bill right now is 689.505, which is pharmacists, drug outlets, and drug sales. The correct reference that will be coming forth to you in an amendment is ORS 676, health professions generally, and it's our recommendation and on the advice of counsel that would be a more appropriate framing. The intent then with this is that we actually then have in the ORS the revision and that the boards can then amend their rules as needed to support their practitioners in supporting the expedited partner therapy. The other point that I wanted to make is that we actually are going to be recommending that we change the framework from just strictly chlamydia and gonorrhea to talk about sexually transmitted diseases. As Dr. Epstein very adequately spoke to, currently the evidence base is only within those two. But if the opportunity comes up in the next couple of years, we don't want to have to revisit and to have to come back to the legislature. We'd rather use it as a rule process. And I think that's what we learned from the California experience. So that will be the other amendment that we'll be providing. But thank you very much. We've got our written testimony, in fact, and then I think also Dr. Epstein, and then we have several other folks to speak to this.
Great. Thank you, Kathy. Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I will attempt not to be redundant because your excellent questions already sort of wrung out from me a lot of the information I was planning on presenting. Again, my name is Beth Epstein. I'm the health officer for Wasco, Sherman, and Hood River counties, and I am also the medical consultant for the Office of Family Health. And I am truly delighted to have the opportunity to speak out in favor of this bill. I've been personally working on this for about 3 years. I never dreamt how hard such a simple thing would be, but I truly believe that this will help us take better care of our patients and our families in Oregon. The traditional methods of partner notification, as you may be aware, are when someone comes into a clinic and is diagnosed with a sexually transmitted disease, the patient themselves may be urged to go to their partners and persuade them to come back. Another option is that the patient can provide contact information to the provider or to the public health professionals, and we offer to take on that role. The reality is that patients are often not very successful in persuading their partners to come in, and that public health is really overburdened and just doesn't get as much follow-up on these patient partners as we really would like to see happen. We're really good when there's something super scary like syphilis, we can be all over that, but when there's something as common as chlamydia, where there may be as many as 28 or 30,000 new cases in Oregon every year, we can't stay on top of that. And an awful lot of cases are just going unfollowed. There's a lot of reasons, I think Dr. Livingston alluded to, there's a lot of reasons why partners may not come in. The patient may not be very persuasive. The partner or the patient may have concerns about confidentiality. I know that's something we think a lot about in our more rural clinics where everybody knows someone and people are just reluctant to come forward identified as the partner of someone who's been diagnosed with chlamydia or gonorrhea. And then there's the very real, you know, people don't have insurance. In my communities, a lot of people are agricultural laborers, and they may not have transportation or a work schedule that jives with the schedule of public health when they can come in and get treated. So there's a lot of different reasons why people don't come in, but the upshot is that we're seeing reinfections. We actually for a long time thought that our medications weren't working. We thought, this is antibiotic resistance. We're seeing more and we're treating chlamydia and then we're seeing it again. We're failing to treat. And for a long time the CDC talked about tests of cure. We needed to test people after they'd been treated to make sure that it would work. Well, we did enough tests of cures and what we found out is we were clearing the infections, but then lo and behold, sometime in the next 3 months to a year, the people were coming back with new infections. And then when you drilled down and talked to people, you found out they were having relations with the same partners who had never gotten treated. And it just sort of piles on, and it's not rocket science. There's some ways we could intervene. But a lot of our traditional ideas and structure of how we practice medicine have kept us from being able to do that. So I think that's kind of the framework that I really wanted to present with this. A real typical story is a young woman comes into my clinic with chlamydia. She is very reluctant to name her partner. She hints that he's married. She states very adamantly, he will never come in. I know he won't come in. And then over the next 18 months, we saw her two more times for chlamydia infections. And then ultimately, she was lost to follow-up. Whether she moved out of the area, we don't know. But we will never know whether she's someone who might have benefited from this practice, whether she's someone who's going to go on to, you know, suffer from infertility, chronic pelvic pain, increased risk of transmission of HIV. We will not know that. One more story that I wanted to tell real briefly was a gentleman in his 30s who presented with symptoms of chlamydia and actually begged us to give him medication to take to his partners. He was very upfront. He had three partners. He wanted us to provide him with the medication, and we had to explain to him we can't do that under Oregon law. We can't do that. And he then reluctantly provided us with contact information for his three partners. And interestingly, none of that contact information actually ever got us in touch with a living person. The information just didn't lead to contacts that we could bring people in. And again, we were left wondering, how far is this infection going? You know, who are the next three people we're going to see who are part of this same chain? And he had wanted to do the right thing in his mind. He wanted to get treatment to his partners, but he did not feel he was in a position to give us the information that we needed to track people down and really bring them in effectively. So those are just, you know, this is one of our most frustrating situations that we face because we've got the patient, we've got medicines that work beautifully, we know how to treat it, we know how to counsel the patients in front of us, and then there's this sort of black box out there that we have no way of influencing the outcomes. And this is just one more tool in our quiver that would let us have that impact. So I guess in summary, what I'd say is the evidence is out there that this can be life-saving, cost-effective. I think we can save Oregonians' health, and I think we can save public health dollars. I think we can save money and human suffering, and I really feel like I would love to see this become an alternative option for providers in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony and for your coming. Any quick questions of anyone on this panel?
Yeah, one.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. How many other states have this?
Representative Maurer and Chair Tomei, 11.
11.
I can't name them all off the top of my head, but I do have them written down. But they include California, Washington, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Minnesota, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Pennsylvania.
Okay. Madam Chair, my wife is a nurse practitioner, and we had this conversation about this piece of legislation. And she says, she practiced in Illinois, so they did that there routinely. But it was a migrant population they were dealing with. And so I don't know if it was allowed in Illinois, but they were doing it. So.
Perhaps I shouldn't comment.
You know, sometimes practitioners find ways.
Well, Representative Maurer and Chair Tomei, I think that was actually, again, one of the CDC's points is this is happening all across the country.
Yes.
And it's just that we can probably have it happen in a safer and more regulated way with better outcomes.
Thank you so much, the three of you, for coming today to testify and giving us excellent information. We appreciate it. Next, I call up Gary Oxman and Tracy Klein. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this? I see a lot of new faces out there, and we'd love if you could come up and tell us who you are and what you have to say about this bill. Anyone else who wants to speak? A lot of shy people out there. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Gary Oxman. I'm a public health physician, been practicing in local public health here in Oregon for about the last 24 years, and I'm offering my testimony on behalf of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. I've submitted written testimony, and to save your time, I'll just hit on a few highlights here. The Coalition of Local Health Officials is a not-for-profit association of Oregon's local public health departments, and we strive to improve local public health practice throughout the state through policy advocacy and improving the knowledge, skills, and abilities of local public health workers and leaders. I serve as the chair of the Health Officer Caucus of the Coalition, and that is the caucus that comprises the public health physicians who practice as health officers throughout the state. The Coalition is very supportive of House Bill 3022 because we believe that it adds an essential set of tools to the toolbox in controlling sexually transmitted infections. As you've heard from previous folks who have testified, really what the bill does is it gives the appropriate licensing boards the statutory authority to do rulemaking to allow expedited partner therapy to occur. It takes down some of the legal barriers that practitioners currently face in doing so. From kind of the big picture perspective, control of sexually transmitted infections depends not only on prompt treatment of patients, but also timely preventive therapy for their partners. And as Dr. Epstein said, the traditional approach to this is for a public health worker, typically a community health nurse or what we call a disease intervention specialist, to interview with the patient who has a sexually transmitted infection and to find out from them who are their sexual partners and then to perform outreach on those sexual partners. That's the ideal. That outreach is successful. They bring them into clinic where they can then be evaluated, tested, and given treatment as appropriate. Unfortunately, that ideal doesn't come about as often as we would like. For a disease like chlamydia in Oregon, we are successful in interviewing only about 50% of those patients, and then we are successful in finding sexual contacts with those patients in fewer than, you know, obviously we don't reach everybody. So the bottom line is that it's really difficult to successfully intervene in a disease in a population if you're reaching out and successfully intervening with less than half the folks who might be impacted. So this is a situation where we really need to new tools to improve a systemic approach, and expedited partner therapy is that new tool. One of the things I wanted to point out is that expedited therapy is not just a tool for governmental public health agencies. It's a tool for all practitioners in the state to use. And you've heard others testify to the fact that physicians and nurse practitioners and others do, in a non-systematic fashion, use expedited partner therapy currently. It's not done on an unnamed basis, but when you, they're, in the studies done by the Centers for Disease Control, they find that more than half of the practitioners in general practice in the selected communities had used expedited partner therapy, and that a smaller fraction of them used it fairly regularly. And so this is something that is happening, and again, the issue is trying to normalize that practice, standardize it, and improve it. And that's really where Health Bill 3022 comes in. Again, it gives rulemaking authority to the various licensing boards and really will help us collaborate with those licensing boards to address these barriers to implementation. You've heard others testify as to the cost effectiveness of this. I would really agree that that's the case, and particularly with the budget struggles that we are all facing in Oregon right now, we need cost-effective tools to carry out public health goals. There was a question earlier about whether this was endorsed by national associations. Yes, the Centers for Disease Control clearly endorses this, as does the American Medical Association. And then here in the state, our coalition of local health officials endorses this policy. So briefly, that's really all I wanted to bring to your attention. If you have any questions, I would be happy to address them.
Thank you so much.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Tracy Klein. I'm a family nurse practitioner practicing in Tigard, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Board of Nursing. I'm the advanced practice consultant with the board, so I would be the person in charge of writing the regulations that would enable this statute if it passed. And I think that you've seen a lot of the points that are on my written testimony, so I will just refer to that. But the point that was important to emphasize is that the passage of this would allow us and the other health regulatory boards to address any obstacles to this practice in rule, because right now for nurse practitioners this would not be possible based on the way that our administrative rules are written. So it's important to get a message that this is legal to do, so that people who are doing it will appropriately document it, and also it would provide consistency from board to board rather than having one board make a policy, another board make a rule, another board have a statute. I think that was what really came out of the meetings that we all had together as regulatory boards. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel?
All right.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Is this your last group to?
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak? Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't have a specific question. I just had to throw my two bits worth in, so I wanted to make sure I wasn't.
I'm going to ask Catherine to come back up.
Okay.
So do you want to hold on to
sure.
that? Great. Thank you so much for coming
thank
to
you.
Testify today. We really appreciate the work you've done on this bill. So, Catherine, I have a question to ask of you. Have you already applied for your amendments?
Chair Tomei, they were submitted on Friday.
Okay, great. Would it be helpful if my staff were to ask for that be expedited?
Chair Tomei, we would appreciate that opportunity.
Okay, we will do that.
Yes.
I had another question, and I can't remember what it was, so Representative Cowan, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to offer my support for this, my strong support for this. And it was sort of interesting to me as I listened to the various questions. I do think that it's important we get the amendments through to allow for a non-named mm-hmm. prescription to be written. In terms of covering that, it would seem to me that if one wishes to pursue insurance coverage, then they would ask for a name on their prescription in order to get it. But if not, those are pretty inexpensive prescriptions, and just getting them out there. I was struck with thinking about the importance of counseling, and I know that in safe practices and that sort of thing, I know that that is done as you're working with any individual, but not treating because you can't get that specific individual face-to-face works just about as well as the just say no approach to pregnancy prevention, too. Couldn't help but thinking that. I think the cost of not treating far outweighs moving in this direction, and particularly for what is very well-intentioned common practice, being able to legalize a document and know what we're doing. From a medical perspective, in my mind, seems far more important than anything else. So I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this legislation forward. Thanks for indulging me.
Thank you. So that brought up the other question I had. Will there be a fiscal impact on this?
Chair Tomei and committee, the department has reviewed this and does not see a fiscal impact on this. And it really is that piece of being able to sort of offset the reoccurrence of infection. And then the other point I just wanted to remind the committee, again, this is not the first alternative of choice for providers. It is the last alternative, but it simply is another mechanism that we can use within the public health system.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions of Madam Chair, Representative Maurer?
So I have a hard time believing that there's no fiscal on this. And it may be positive. But, I mean, to have it flat, this seems completely unrealistic. It's either going to cost you a little bit or you're going to gain a little bit, or maybe a lot. But, I mean, just to say that there's no fiscal because someone said there's no fiscal doesn't seem to...
Let's let Catherine.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, our sexually transmitted disease program reviewed this and then had conversations with several of the other state public health systems that have already implemented this. And as I indicated, there were 11 other states that have done this. And the response back that they got was that it just hadn't had much impact in terms of cost, because that really was one of the concerns we had initially, is would this actually double the costs in some way in our sexually transmitted disease program, since they're the ones that do provide the drugs in many cases for our clinics. So on the basis of the experience of the other states, we came back with that this would not have a significant impact. We had some of the same concerns, but we just didn't find similar practice in other states.
Thank you, Catherine. Anyone else? Thank you again for all your work on this, and everybody who was here today who I know have been working on this. Thank you very much. It's bringing us a good bill. We're anxious to see the amendment and hopefully pass it out of this committee and send it on the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any further comments? Okay, I will close the first public hearing on House Bill 3022 right now. And thank you all for coming today. As we saw it snowing, I know that some of you had a little hairy time getting in this morning. Thank you for coming and being here on time. And I'll close.
Couldn't get here on time.
Well, almost. Apologies. Almost. House Committee on Human Services is adjourned. Thank you so much.